Tatăl, plină sutra.
For a moment about the process by which I wrote this talk, by which I write talks, is very interesting. I start writing a talk probably about 2 months before I give it. And I do that by sitting with the koan for several weeks or a month or more. And then I start to kind of write the talk in my head. And it's only like the last few days before I present the talk that I actually put it on paper. But what amazed me was this morning in Daisan, how synchronous what's in this talk is with what's going on with many of you. And so there are a number of you who I told that you need to pay attention this morning. And so put your listening ears on, please. So, once again today, I would like to offer a talk that is related to springtime, for some reason. And I'll digress only briefly to say, you know, like last night in Hollowell was our annual black fly supper. And there are so many wonderful ways that you can prepare them. But I don't want to offend the vegetarians in the group. But I will say that the shoe fly pie was in. Anyway. So what we're going to look at, though, setting that aside, is what in my view is one of the most beautiful koans. And I said I doubt that this talk will even begin to do it justice, but I know that this talk will not begin to do it justice. The following case is from the Blue Cliff Record. Changsha wandering in the mountains. One day Changsha went wandering in the mountains. Upon returning, when he got to the gate, the head monk asked, "Where are you coming from, master?" Sha said, "From wandering in the mountains." The head monk asked, "Where did you go?" Sha said, "First I went pursuing the fragrant grasses, then I returned following the falling flowers." The head monk said, "How very much like the sense of springtime." Sha said, "It even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses." Sui Tu added the remark, "Thanks for your reply." As some of you may be aware, the question, "Where are you coming from?" when asked in this way, has little to do with geography. It was often used by Chan teachers to test the understanding of a newcomer. Sui Tu, who compiled the Blue Cliff Record, tells us that this koan is related to an earlier case where Yang Shan asked a monk, "Where did you come from?" The monk said, "Mount Lu." Yang Shan said, "Did you visit the Five Elders' Peak?" The monk said, "I didn't get there." Yang Shan said, "You never visited the mountain at all." What can we make of this exchange between Yang Shan and the monk? I just suggested that asking the monk where he was coming from was a way of testing him, of seeing his depth, seeing his understanding. What do you think the monk was saying when he replied, "Mount Lu"?
You're asking us?
I'm asking, yes. I'm asking you, yes.
Well, that monk might have meant the geography.
He might very well have meant the geography, yes. So, Yang Shan persisted. "Did you visit the Five Elders' Peak?" The monk said, "I didn't get there at all." Yang Shan said, you never visited the mountain at all. So what's going on in that second part?
Shifts from the relative to the absolute.
Who shifts from the relative to the absolute?
Well, they may both shift, but it's for sure that Yang Shan is saying, you know, the Five Elders Peak is that's going to the mountain that isn't there. It's not a literal visit to the Five Elders Peak.
Yeah, it seems to me that the monk stays in the geography, and hence you never visited the mountain at all. I assume that mountain is a monastery and so this monk hadn't been there. But if, in the case at hand with Changsha, the tables are turned. It's the monk who's asking the questions. Is he trying to best the old man? Perhaps. But it's also possible that initially he's simply greeting him as he returns to the monastery. Sha giving an immediate and direct response from wandering in the mountains. But just like Yang Shan in that last koan, the monk doesn't stop here. Where did you go? He asks. As Peter Harris recently reminded me, these old masters constantly revealed the Dharma in every moment. What an amazing response Changsha gives as the monk presses him on his wanderings. First I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned following the falling flowers. He shows himself as a worthy successor of Nanchuan in Matsu's lineage. What is Changsha telling us? Did his wandering lead him into deep enchantment with that spring day? It seems possible. After all, isn't that what spring can do to us? The heady aroma of the rich green spring grass, the delicate fluttering of falling apple blossoms on the heels of winter's cold, wet, and mud. Can any of us escape being drawn into rapture at those moments? Why on earth would we want to escape that? It seems the monk thinks that Sha may have been taken this way. How very much like the sense of springtime, he tells Sha. Once again, the master's instantaneous response has a rare quality of poetic elegance. It even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses. It is here that Changsha's teaching in the dialogue is revealed. It even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses. What is it that surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses? That it is what our Zen practice is all about. Sometimes we call it the great reality. It is boundless, encompassing everything. Like the autumn dew on the lotus, it is very, very clear. In the commentary on the koan, we are also told that Tenkei Dunsan points out the fact that the autumn dew is also cool. It is not the flame of rapture we may feel on a spring day, which flares up with intensity, but is quickly lost as we anticipate the heat of summer, followed by the first fall nights heralding the return to a dark, cold winter. It is not blemished by impermanence. Nor is it the flush that comes with the realization of the absolute, which can sweep us away with its own form of heated intoxication. So now we know where Master Sha has been. Wandering, wandering, lost forever. Fragrant grasses wave in the breeze. That's all. Spring blossoms descend. The trees put forth their leaves. Bird songs arise from unseen thrushes. Wandering in complete freedom. This is the freedom of Hotai, sitting in the dusty marketplace, his great belly bouncing with laughter as he plays with the children. Young Men tells us that even if you realize that there is no trouble at all in mountain, rivers, and earth, Still, this is a turning phrase. When you do not see any forms, this is only half the issue. You must further realize that there is a time when the whole thing is brought up, the single opening upward. Only then can you sit in peace. Sueto adds, if you can pass through, then as before, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. Each abides in its own state. Each occupies its own body. You will become a completely blind man. It is the freedom of Chaucho who versifies. The cock crows in the early morning. Sadly, as I see as I rise how worn out I am. I haven't a kilt or a shirt, just a semblance of a robe. My loincloth has no seat. My pants have no opening. On my head are 3 or 5 pecks of gray ashes. Originally, I intended to practice to help save others. Who would have suspected that instead I would become an idiot? But if we wish to experience, as Changsha and these other great teachers have, if we wish to fully and deeply realize it, do we need to go wandering in the mountains? Could we realize it in the New York subway, for example? Could we just as easily say, I went following the crowd on the IRT line and returned with the evening commute on the BMT? Can we be free doing the dishes, parenting our children, working at our desks, or running back to the store for the eggs we forgot? I think the answer is yes. Not only is it possible for us to awaken fully in all of those places, I don't think that our practice has any value unless we do. Zen that cannot live in the chaos of our 21st century lives, in the mundane and ordinary, even in the stress, pain, and confusion, is not Zen worth having. Because Buddhist practices are sometimes associated with stress reduction in our culture, people seem to believe that we must disengage from our complex lives in order to practice Zen. Sitting on the cushions, we attain a beatific calm that we bring into the simple, relaxing lives that we share exclusively with like-minded, loving people. Please do not get me wrong. I personally believe that most of us can benefit from simplifying our frenetic, multitasking existences. Our planet can definitely benefit as well. So in my mind, this is essential. What I am saying is that in my view, this is not only a prerequisite for Zen, it can become an impediment to our Zen practice. Our practice must extend into every areas of our lives, opening us to experience each moment deeply with compassion, regardless of where we are or what we are doing. As the Buddha points out, to have this human life is the rarest of opportunities. We should use it well. There's a little segment in Peter Matheson's book, Nine-Headed Dragon River, that made a strong impression on me many years ago, and I often share with clients in my work. I think it's a wonderful illustration of the freedom I've been talking about, and I'd like to share it in closing. I'll give you a little bit of the context. This takes place when Peter was in Tibet, along with a biologist friend, looking for the elusive snow leopard. And he wrote a book on that entitled The Snow Leopard. And then this book was kind of his, in part, his spiritual sort of journals on that trip. And he happened to visit a monastery called She Gampa, which translates as the Crystal Monastery. And some of the background for this is actually, I think, is in The Snow Leopard. I somehow know things that are not in this book, which I think must be from when I read that. It was in a very high, very precipitous place with a narrow, narrow path being the only way that you could reach it. And he spent some time there, and at some point has an interview with the Lama. And during the course of that interview, of that discussion, he suddenly realizes that the Lama is crippled, that his legs have atrophied, and as might happen to many of you this morning, sitting in meditation posture, it happens every so often. But anyway, and that therefore, there's absolutely no way he can ever get off this mountain because the path is so narrow, somebody can't carry him down, or you know that it just he's there. And so this is this little discussion that takes place. The Lama of the Crystal Mount Monastery appears to be a very happy man. And yet I wonder how he feels about his isolation in the silences of Tsakang, where he has not left for 8 years, and now, because he is crippled, may never leave again. Since Jangbu seems uncomfortable with the Lama, or with himself, or perhaps with us, I tell him not to inquire on this point if it seems to him impertinent. But after a moment, Jangbu does so. And this holy man of great directness and simplicity, big white teeth shining, laughs out loud in an infectious way at Jangbu's question, indicating his twisted legs without a trace of self-pity or bitterness. They belong to all of us. He casts his arms wide to the sky and the snow mountains, the high sun and the dancing sheep, and cries, "Of course I'm happy here. It's wonderful, especially when I have no choice." In its wholehearted acceptance of what is, this is just what Soen Roshi might have said. I feel as if he had struck me in the chest. I thank him, bow softly, and go down the mountain. Butter tea and wind pictures, the crystal mountain and the blue sheep dancing on the snow. It's quite enough. Have you seen the snow leopard? No. Isn't that wonderful?
Did you want people to speak? Or?
Only if they're going to say things that flatter me and make me feel. If you want to revile the company, people are welcome, of course, the comments, questions.
I'm so confused about that first thing with the visiting the peak and saying, well, you haven't visited the mountain at all. Can you clarify? Or should I say what I think?
Yeah, please, say what you think.
Well, I had a thought it could be something like, well, maybe visit, you don't have to actually visit the peak, but you can visit the peak in another way, and he didn't do that because he got distracted by spring. And that was one thought. And another thought was, well, you have to like reach the highest point in order to be have visited the mountain.
I mean, in one case, in one level, he is speaking about a place, right? And again, I'm assuming that that Mount Lu was a monastery or a practice center that this monk was coming from. Right? And yet, again, that question where you're coming from is not just asking about geography, but usually you get to talk about geography one time before the teacher then kind of shifts gears on you and says, "Come on, I really want to know," you know, which is what I think Yangshan did. And so he kind of raised it by saying, well, what about, have you visited the Five Elders Peak? Which may be a metaphorical place, or it may, you know, it may be a place on the mountain. But I think, again, he's saying, come on, I want to see what you're, you know. And it, again, it seems to me that the monk's response is just staying with, oh, I never got there, you know. And so when he's saying you never visit the mountain at all, you haven't learned the teaching that that teacher on that mountain, you know, had you know, you haven't opened.
Because he was sticking to geography and the fact that he didn't, like, think beyond geography, meant that he hadn't gotten the teaching?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I assume just like if you were a teacher in that time and asked this question, you know, you were testing, you know, monks knew this also. I mean, it's kind of, this was a process that was going on constantly in these monasteries. As Peter said, often they would, you know, ask the question in the relative, and then the response would be in the absolute, and then they kind of bounce back and forth in a, you know, what we would call a Dharma combat thing almost. But our sense is, I think, from the koans that this was going on almost constantly within the life of these monasteries. And so that a monk who's been somewhere to practice and is now coming to another place should have a kind of a clue about what's going on. And would, if they had some degree of realization, would kind of try to show that in their response. In their, that, Margaret, you're looking over, did that?
No, I don't. I agree with you. I'm looking over to just see you, actually.
It's almost like there's the Mount Lu, but then there's the Mount Lu of one's true nature. Which one is?
Yeah, that's kind of
if, good. If you get to the Mount Lu of one's true nature, then you've seen the Five Elders Peak. You just got to climb the mountain and looked off at the ranges in the distance, you missed the point of that entirely. Yeah. That's sort of what it says to me.
And that's to me as well. You know, we could change Mount Lu to Mount Blue or, you know, whatever we want.
There's also the Mount Lu, which I think Jen was talking about, which might have been preconceived notion of what it would be, which is also a very potent delusion of which can sidetrack us very easily.
But still going off that thought about, oh, he knew. He thought he knew everything, like an ego thing. And then, like, the other monk or the teacher says, "Have you visited the Five Elders Peak?" Is that maybe that's like saying, like it's a blow. Like, I want to take your ego out of the picture. Like, you haven't visited here.
See, I don't see it so much as an ego thing at all. He's just answering literally. Have you been to Mount Lu? Yeah, I was at Mount Lu. Today, when you come home tonight, I'll ask, did you get up to Cadillac Mountain? And I say, yes, we went up Cadillac Mountain, or no, we didn't get there. But I think that's the level the monk is answering on.
Yeah.
And then the teacher raises it up a notch and starts asking, well, what did you learn there? But he doesn't ask directly. Those, you'll find that none of those Chinese teachers ever asked anything directly.
It would be too easy.
Yeah.
Remember when we went to Israel, everyone asked us, have you been to the desert? Have you spent time in the desert? And we'd say, no. And their eyes would fall. Mm-hmm. I mean, you haven't been to Israel. God is in the desert. So in order to go to Israel, you have to leave Israel.
I guess it's easy to paint stories like if one person isn't looking at it on that level, then they would take the question to be like a superiority inferiority thing. Like I get from it, like have you been here? It's like a, if you haven't, you didn't get it.
Mm-hmm. There's being there, and then there's being there.
Mm-hmm. Yourselves pointed that out.
Really?
But then will we be
there?
Yes.
The flowers will bloom just that spring.
Plants the gardener.
Yeah.
What is the name of this movie?
Being.
I never saw the movie.
Oh, my God. You have to run to see that. Right?
It's a movie, yeah. Older movie, and it just always.
Oh, okay.
But not Tate Gunther.
No.
I was thinking about the second part, the reading that you did from Peter Matheson, and I've heard that little piece before. It was great to hear. Somehow the vividness was much stronger. And I was thinking, for some reason, it just got me thinking about 12-step programs and the whole question of what it is that you just bear in your life, just work with, and just kind of deal with, and as best you can, and with a good attitude as best you can, or with acceptance as best you can, and what you really work to change, because either in yourself or in the world or in your family or in people you work with or however it is, it's not a good thing or a healthy thing. And it just seems like he raised that question really vividly, because he had something that was just unchangeable, and so his attitude was, of course I'm happy, of course, you know, I don't have a choice, I'm working with it. But then if the situation came along where there was a cure for what he had, or someone could carry him down, or there was that other circumstance, then, you know, like, it sort of got me thinking, well, what if there's, you know, you have a serious illness and you think, well, I'm just bearing with it, and then a cure comes, and then, or like, there was something I remember years ago reading Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and she talks about people who've been blind for years and years and years, and then a cure came along for what they had. Remember that? Yes, I'm cool for that. And then they weren't bearing with anymore because their whole circumstance changed. It was actually very difficult for a lot of people to have that wider scope.
One of the marvelous things about us all is that we can attach to absolutely anything. Including suffering, right? So you can get stuck either way, you know? I mean, my assumption is that if someone could carry this llama down the mountain, then he'd be joyful being carried down the mountain, you know? His state is a little different from when 12-step programs talk about acceptance, although that's what I use this to teach. It's really not exactly what the story is about. What, you know, his, that place of non-attachment, that place of freedom in the sense that we're talking about here, is really not quite the same thing as acceptance. I think that makes sense at all.
Seems like it's a piece of it, isn't it? I mean, it seems like you're talking about with him just being with whatever joyfully. It seems like that. I can't get it in very good words, but that's my best effort, or it's an effort anyway. And acceptance seems like it has a more quality to it. That, so
that's a little bit how I see it.
They're kind of cousins or something.
To have acceptance, we have to have something that we're not accepting. we have to create an obstacle, we have to create a barrier, we have to create a thing that we dislike. And there may be people who are at a point where they're not creating that thing, you know, any more than we're creating the leaves coming out on the trees or the, you know.
I guess my understanding is that in Zen, what we're supposed to do is to be with what is, to accept what is right now, and work to change it if we can or if we need to. But that, as you pointed out, it's easy to, sometimes easier to be with what is when you like what is. What the llama was being with what was, even though most people wouldn't necessarily like that. But he was finding it an opportunity for further practice. He wasn't, because accepting means, to me, means resignation. Mm-hmm. He doesn't sound resigned. He sounds like he just is.
You know, there's a wonderful story. It's Itzhak Perlman, who was doing a concert, and when he was playing, all of a sudden, a string snapped and broke, and everybody hushed. And he said, "Carry on." And you could explain this better. And what he did was he transposed, he had to use four strings rather than three strings rather than four. And he had to transpose the entire piece mentally.
Wow.
In order to carry on with the concert, which he did.
Even harder because of the tension on the strings.
Yes.
The remaining strings don't carry the same pitch after that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's a shift. You don't know how far up or down it's gone. You have to play by ear as well as...
But he did
amazing.
It. And at the end he says, you know, sometimes we have to play with less than one string mm-hmm. and still make music.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you all know that he's quite crippled. And so when, you know, it's very hard work for him to get to where he's
yeah.
going to play. He's got braces on his legs and
polio.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he sat down and the string broke, the audience was like,
oh, not this again.
You know, well, no. Mm-hmm. The poor guy's going to have to walk all the way back.
Get another violin
mm-hmm. and then walk back in. And instead, he didn't say a word. He just started playing. Just signaled to the concertmaster, mm-hmm. start.
I think that's what the Lama is talking about.
He's working with what is.
It's not just, it's
yeah.
accepting what you have and making music.
Yeah.
You make it
your own.
You just
yeah.
Not just bear it, but...
Absorb it.
Absorb.
Yeah. That's good. Sometimes, though, it can... Or, some, well, I get in the trap of thinking, well, it's as Perlman, you know, he's a virtuoso, like, it's so admirable, but... He's also so talented, and I understand how, more normal people can try to get something out of it, but it just to achieve that, it seems like you have to have something innate also.
Strings break in all our lives.
Yeah, I don't think he's any less normal than we are.
He started when he was a little boy learning how to play the violin, like any little boy learning how to play a violin. It probably sounded like but he was, you know, he committed his life to it, and that's why he's so talented now. But it was hard work to get there, and not only was it hard work to get there, it was hard work to get around. And the man can't really walk very well, so he, you know, he was willing to dedicate his life to playing the violin and be willing to walk out on stage in front of everyone with his braces on, you know. That's a lot that man has given. But don't think of him as any different than yourself.
Quick story.
Yes.
Taking a lesson that I studied with him, and we're in his living room, and he's sitting, I'm standing, he's got his Canadian crutches by him, and one of his little kids makes a break for it, gets away from the nurse, comes barreling through the French doors and just creating havoc in there. And he goes, "Toby!" for his wife. No answer. So he sets down the violin. He grabs the crutch. He grabs the kid. He grabs the other crutch. He gets the kid out of the room. I mean, it's just... It's just the person. Just doing what he had to do.
It's interesting how the Lama says that it's nice with no choices and no choice, because we have a lot of choices we can make because we're not up on the mountain, you know. And it's very hard to just do the thing rather than think about doing them. And I feel that's a big part of the practice, is just constantly just do the things rather than think about them. Mm-hmm.
I've screwed up more things by thinking about them. My wife will tell you that.
Take baseball. Mm-hmm. You never can hit the ball.
I've never screwed up baseball looks.
Ask any batter.
Yeah.
When they start thinking,
they can't hit.
They can't hit.
This poppy is
experiencing,
right?
Yeah, poppy.
Cool
poppy. It breaks the heart.
What happened then?
He got one home run.
Yes, yeah, he did. Hit a home run.
First home run. He can't hit.
150 at bats.
Wow.
Poor guy.
What happened?
It happens to everybody.
He probably thought this was going well.
Yeah, he had an injury and he psychologically it affected his swing. So. But then there's Suzuki. What's his name?
Ichiro.
Ichiro.
Suzuki, yes.
Yeah. Who went a huge number of at-bats in spring training without getting a hit. Of course, it was spring training. And he was enjoying it. And he was just looking for the feeling that he had when he was a little kid. And he was disappointed when it came to the end. In other words, it was, there are no misfortunes for the spiritual order. It was a phenomenon that he couldn't hit that many times. So his ego was never threatened by it. He knew that it would come back to him. And he felt surprisingly disappointed when he got the first hit, because that whole process of trying to remain open was never going to happen again. Now he had the hit. That's the way I felt about that story about the I had no choice, which when I first read absolutely knocked me backwards. It was certainly the greatest thing in the book, and it may be the greatest thing that Peter Matheson ever happened to Peter Matheson. But when I read it this last time through, I wasn't blown away. I lost my beginner's mind. And so thank you for bringing it back in the full way.
I think I read that in the Snow Leopard. I think there's a fuller version of that in the Snow Leopard that's even more poetic than that.
I don't know, it's hard to read.
Wasn't the Lama living up on this monastery with one attendant, I think, or something like that, and they lived in and it was cold, and the 20,000+ foot peaks out there, and they lived there alone year in and year out. Oops.
Where do you see people like that as in AA? Just been ground down to the point where they accept. And there's a beauty to it.
Creations are numberless. I bow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I bow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I bow to receive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I bow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I bow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I bow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I bow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I bow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I bow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I bow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I bow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable.